Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
In which we name check the President of these United States. We explain the more exciting than you would think mechanics of a hostile takeover bid. And we explore the gourmet hot dog industry in Chicago, Illinois. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Tuesday, the 2nd of September. Good as always to have you here, everybody. The Commerce Department came out with a new report today on the American export economy. Exports, the report says, are responsible for more than 11 million jobs in this country. We got Commerce Secretary Penny Pritzker on the line earlier today to talk about it. Before we got going, though, we were chatting, Secretary and I, about the last time she was on back in January and what I've been up to since. Here's a little peek behind that curtain for you. I saw your boss in the Oval Office a couple of months ago, so that was good.
Good, good. Yeah. Well, that's better hobnobbing.
Well, you know, I mean, I don't want to drop names, but okay. All right, so name dropping done. I went on to ask the secretary about those 11 million jobs, specifically what kinds of jobs they are.
Well, there's all kinds of jobs. Of the goods export, 88% of them are manufacturing jobs that are created. Those are good jobs. But in general, the exporting jobs that are being created pay 13 to 18% more than the average job. And we're very excited about that. And 1.6 million Americans have new jobs since 2009 because of exports.
One of the things we talked about last time, speaking of who is doing these jobs, is immigration reform. We had you on in January, and I asked you about the prospects for immigration reform, and you said, I'm confident, this is almost a quote, I'm confident it'll be done in the first half of this year. I'm going to give you the opportunity for a mulligan here, Madam Secretary.
Well, you know, the reason for supporting immigration reform has not gone away. First of all, we have a moral responsibility to deal with the 11 million undocumented individuals living in our country. But we also have an economic opportunity that comes with immigration reform. If you look from a more technology and STEM standpoint, we know that over 50% of students in the STEM fields, that in most STEM fields that are getting a master's or PhD, are immigrants. So this is crazy. We're educating all of these terrific young people. They're here in the country, and if they want to stay, why shouldn't we encourage them to stay? It would be good for our businesses, too. They need this kind of talent. I know where we're at, but I believe that pragmatism and the reality will win out over the day and that we will get some kind of action on immigration reform.
I won't ask you to speak for your boss, but do you anticipate that action to be executive action from the White House most likely after the election? Yeah.
Well, you know what? Since you hang out with my boss, I'll let you ask him that question.
Oh, come on. It
but
was just
rather,
once, twice,
I want
maybe
to stay focused on exports today because, you know, we have such great momentum going with our exports. You know, there are cities in this country, Youngstown, Detroit, Kansas City, you know, where 100% of the growth since 2009 has come from exporting.
One of the things that happens when exports are a topic of conversation, especially recently, is that the Export-Import Bank comes up, that government agency that helps basically finance exports for a lot of American companies. There is a great political brouhaha now in Washington about whether or not to renew the charter when it comes due. Why do we need the government to be helping in this way?
Well, it's absolutely imperative that we reauthorize the Export-Import Bank, and I'll tell you why. 60 other countries have Export-Import Banks. The Export-Import Bank, over the last 5 years, has supported the creation of 1.2 million jobs in the United States. We can't afford not to have this tool in our tool chest.
I asked this question against the backdrop of an economy that's growing at 4.2% on an annualized rate, we learned last week.
Isn't that exciting?
It's great news. But here's the thing, and to your report this afternoon, you can't export your way to growth, right? Because everything we export, somebody else has to be buying. And with the dollar at highs and with slowdowns in Europe and over in Asia, how confident are you that this export-led growth can continue?
You know what? I am confident. We have doubled exports to over 30 countries around the world. There are a lot of countries that want our goods and services. And one of the things we want to do is help our companies export because that'll continue to support the kind of GDP growth that we've been seeing.
Penny Pritzker, she is the Secretary of Commerce. Madam Secretary, thanks very much for your time.
Kai, thank you so much.
Split decision on Wall Street today. We will have the details when we do the numbers. There is, as you've heard here and elsewhere, a bidding war going on in the dollar store industry. Family Dollar is the target. Those are the stores with the mostly red logos. Courting it are both Dollar General with the bright yellow letters and the green-logoed competitor Dollar Tree. If you're lost right about here, don't worry about it. The key thing to know is that Dollar General's advances have been rejected by Family Dollar, which might at some point get us to that most entertaining of corporate transactions, the hostile takeover bid. Here's Marketplace's Scott Tong.
Say you're Dollar General, and you're smitten by the fetching Family Dollar. You offer the most money, and you get rejected. Michael Goldstein teaches finance at Babson College.
Just like in a family, if two families are trying to negotiate over marriage and somebody comes in with a slightly higher dowry, but you think the marriage might be better, or she's actually in love with somebody different, you might not take the highest offer.
We're talking about the rejecting company's board. And when the board says no, you can go around them. That's called going hostile.
Well, what you're doing at that point is you're making an offer directly to the shareholders.
Former investment banker Donna Hittrich is now with Columbia Business School. She says by now, you're hostile to the board, but making nice with the shareholders.
The shareholders are the owners of the company, right? It's their capital that's been committed. And so if they determine to sell, they can do that.
You offer shareholders X dollars per share, and enough sell to you, you control the target company. The catch? Well, in a hostile case, you're flying half blind. Securities lawyer Bill Caffey says in a friendly deal, you send your lawyers to their lawyers and do lots of research and collect lots of information.
And if you're going hostile, obviously you're not. You're just kind of shooting into the wind and looking at their public filings and saying, yeah, we think it's worth X dollars and here we go for it.
Also, if word of a hostile takeover leaks out, hungry investors can push up the target stock price, and up go your wedding costs. You, of course, are counting the dollars because, well, you're the dollar store. I'm Scott Tong for Marketplace.
Eric Cantor has a new gig. The former House Majority Leader resigned in August after losing his primary, as you'll remember. Now, he's going to be a banker, Moelis & Company. What is known in the trade as a boutique investment firm says Cantor will join it as vice chairman and managing director. He has exactly 0 years of experience working on Wall Street, Mr. Cantor does, but he is still a hot hire, as Marketplace's Noel King explains.
Back when he was still candidate Cantor, Moelis already had its eye on the House Majority Leader. Sheila Krumholz of the Center for Responsive Politics says over the course of his career, Moelis was one of Cantor's donors.
He got $15,200, with $10,000 of that going to his leadership PAC. Not a huge sum of money, but he was clearly in their sights. He was important to them, and of course they are now important to him.
Why is Cantor so important to Moelis? Jeff Berry, a professor of political science at Tufts, says the giveaway is that Cantor is opening the firm's Washington, D.C. office.
He's not opening a Washington office because they see deals in Northern Virginia and want to be close to him. He's opening a Washington office so he can open doors for the investment bank and help them with regulatory problems.
Cantor will start at a salary of $400,000 a year, but will get bonuses and stock options worth around $3 million more. Moelis, which frequently advises on mergers and acquisitions, said in a statement that Cantor was hired to develop clients and give them strategic advice. Dennis Kelleher, the CEO of Better Markets, a nonprofit that promotes the public interest in finance, says Cantor's resume would indicate that mergers and acquisitions probably aren't his area of expertise.
One could argue, it seems to me, that he wouldn't even be qualified to be an intern at most of the firms on Wall Street.
Kelleher says what Cantor can do for the firm is provide information, contacts, and access to his former colleagues on Capitol Hill. I'm Noel King for Marketplace.
What do you do if you want to build a workforce, a high-skill, high-tech workforce that is as good as any in the world? Step one might be to look at who already does that and then copy them. Germany has been churning out highly skilled professionals for jobs in engineering and advanced manufacturing for decades now. From North Carolina Public Radio, Leonita Inge has that story.
Dozens of North Carolinians are visiting Germany this year to get a firsthand look at its apprenticeship programs. And one of the main stops is in Berlin at the Siemens Professional Education Center.
So, yeah, now we are here also in the part of the vocational training for mechatronics and industrial mechanics.
Martin Strickman heads Siemens Professional Education in northern Germany. He's personally escorting a group of North Carolina public school teachers from classroom to workroom. Strickman says their approach to education allows students to see and touch.
That means the system approach is a basic idea of training what we provide here in Germany.
It's all about engineering at this Siemens Center. In this classroom, students are working on automation technology. Germany's dual vocational training system has been getting a lot of attention these days. This apprenticeship model is credited with work guarantees for young people and keeping the jobless rate low. Marius Kuhn is 21 years old. He says he was one of the lucky ones to get into the Siemens program.
We have good possibilities in the world market to get a job. That's why I'm here by Siemens to learn electrical engineering.
There are about 1,300 students at this particular Siemens Education Center, but Strickman says more than 40,000 young people applied for the company's training program. Those odds sound more like trying to get into Harvard or Stanford. Diane Cherry is a policy manager at the Institute for Emerging Issues at North Carolina State University. She says the state has a lot to learn from Germany in linking the right workers with the best jobs.
It's a partnership between the community college system and educational institutions and manufacturers to really take advantage of the opportunities that are there.
Cherry will be visiting Germany this month along with economic developers, community college administrators, and members of the North Carolina legislature. Middle school teacher Anna Creech made the trip to Germany and to Siemens this summer. Creech says she will spend a good part of this new school year trying to expose students to what she experienced.
Having sixth graders, they have a hard time thinking to next week, much less what they want their careers to be. But that's what I'm encouraging them, is to start thinking and investigate and look around and consider the different opportunities.
And in a state where the unemployment rate for young people is one of the highest in the country, it's never too early to start. I'm Leonita Inge for Marketplace.
Coming up.
There's no such thing as a hot dog franchise in Chicago, but they might as well be a franchises because they're all exactly alike.
Which is what you call a very tasty business opportunity. But first, let's do the numbers. As I said, a mixed day on Wall Street today. The Dow Industrial is off 30 points, about 0.2%, closed at 17,067. The NASDAQ picked up 17 points, almost 0.4%, finished at 45.98. The S&P 500 lopped off a point, less than 0.1%, ended things at 2002. Norwegian Cruise Lines was among the biggest gainers of the day. Shares sailed up 11% on word the firm would buy Prestige Cruises International from its owner, that is Apollo Global Management, for 3 billion simoleons. Oh, the power of a simoleon, as it were. As the dollar store saga we told you about earlier continues to play out, shares in all three of those players rose. Dollar Tree to the tune of 1.5%, Dollar General more than 0.5%, Family Dollar almost 0.5%, and I think we are done with the dollar story. Halliburton will settle a big swath of claims related to the Gulf of Mexico oil spill back in 2010 for $1.1 billion. The company also said challenges in Russia, Iraq, and Libya will hurt it come earnings time, and yet somehow shares only off about 0.2%. You're listening to Marketplace.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Tuesday. How many folks wrapped up the summer with new wheels? U.S. automakers are slated to report sales for August. The Federal Reserve releases its latest Beige Book summary of commentary on current economic conditions. And television soap Search for Tomorrow premiered on September 3rd, 1951. The search went on for 35 years. I'm Michelle Filippi.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdal. Indian Prime Minister Narendra Modi is in Tokyo this week trying to drum up some business. Demography, democracy, and demand was his pitch to Japanese business leaders in a speech today. In fact, Modi wraps up his 100th day in office today, a period that held high hopes for a pro-business administration. Sutrajit KK is the editor of Quartz India. We had him on just after the Indian election a couple of months ago, so we have called him up again. Sutrajit, good to talk to you.
Good to be back on your show, Kai.
When we spoke a number of months ago, right after the prime minister was elected, it was very much an optimistic time. People were looking at him as a Reagan-Thatcher model who was going to get things going in business. He would be able to motivate young people. Has any of that panned out in the last 100 days?
You're absolutely right. His election was indeed a time of great optimism. And I would say that not much has changed. A lot of that optimism continues to be. In fact, in a recent survey conducted by India Today, which is a major national magazine, 61% of people said that Modi makes for an excellent prime minister.
The catch, of course, is that there's 1.1 billion people in that economy, and he's only going to be able to touch a part of it. So what are people saying? You know, forget the markets, forget companies. What are people saying on the streets as they go about their daily lives?
There is some concern that he hasn't done enough, but there are enough indications that he is laying the groundwork slowly and steadily to be able to then leapfrog and do much bigger things. Hmm. Another point to note, another point I would like to flag is that there are at this point very few technocrats in the government. The government does not have a chief economic advisor, which it was thought that several economists, mostly from universities in the United States or from the IMF, were in contention. They have not been appointed. The Modi has done away with the Planning Commission, which has been at the commanding heights of Indian economy for more than 5 decades now. But a replacement, he wants to put in place another think tank that will think about how the economy needs to be structured, what different ways should states and the central government share revenues and all of that. But that has yet to be constituted. So without these technocrats being in place, you know, the full extent of the government decision-making and deliberating and policy-making is not really going to come into effect. And I think many people are waiting for that to happen.
What's your sense of how some of the big multinational companies are viewing the Indian economy now as a place to maybe take on some risk? I mean, Sony is thinking about setting up manufacturing there for the first time in decades. Coca-Cola, on the other hand, is saying it's not going to go in.
Yeah, so I think broadly the sentiment is positive. In June, we saw that foreign direct investment inflows were 34% higher than what it was during June last year. So the broad trend is positive, but there is no sense that a floodgate has opened and a large number of companies want to come in or people are announcing that. That certainly hasn't happened. On all these fronts, there is certainly a tremendous scope for improvement and a lot of scope for more and more companies to come in. But also Indian companies, if the market sentiment was definitely improving, we would see more and more Indian companies going public. The IPO market has been completely down and out in India for a while. I read every other day that, you know, a great new season for IPOs are coming. But we're yet to see that really play out.
Sutrajit KK, he edits Quartz India. Sutrajit, thank you very much for your time.
Pleasure being with you, Kai.
The tech story this Tuesday, as it has been for a day or so now, is about internet privacy, or more accurately, the lack thereof. Nude pictures of the actress Jennifer Lawrence and other female celebrities were posted on a message board called 4chan over the weekend. 4chan hosts completely anonymous discussions, many, many of which are not remotely safe for work or for this radio broadcast. It's a complicated place, 4chan is. It's home for snark, nastiness, and in the past couple of years, political activism as well. The Occupy Movement's Guy Fawkes masks, remember those? They owe a debt to 4chan. And if you have ever shared a photo of, I don't know, a cat with a weird caption on it, so too do you. Marketplace's Dan Weissman has more.
4chan was created in 2003 as a forum where people could discuss various interests, like Japanese comics, each with its own discussion board. And for topics that didn't fit elsewhere, there was B.
people always said, well, if it's too off point or it's too crude or if it's just too, you know, it's too much for the rest of the site, take it to B. Take this discussion to B.
That's filmmaker Brian Knappenberger, who's made a couple of documentaries about the political activism that eventually grew out of 4chan. B remains an anything-goes place and extremely not safe for work.
Like, really awful stuff on B. I would highly recommend nobody going to B at all.
One thing that allows 4chan to be so anarchic is that everyone posting there is anonymous. Engineer Austin Wilson says he's an occasional regular there.
There's no real community to 4chan. There's just a bunch of people that go to this website, but they don't know who any of the other people are.
Other stuff grew out of B, some of which filtered out to the rest of the world. One was LOL cats, those pictures your niece sends you. Another was the political group that calls itself Anonymous, which got known for shutting down corporate and government sites, often to protest privacy breaches. McGill University anthropologist Gabriella Coleman studies 4chan and Anonymous. She says there are some obvious contradictions here.
On the one hand, there clearly is this value placed on privacy and anonymity and shielding the self. But on the other hand, 4chan is, you know, an epicenter for kind of violating people's privacy by exposing people's photographs.
In Chicago, I'm Dan Weissman for Marketplace.
Ah, Chicago, city of the big shoulders, home of the deep dish pizza and the Japanese seaweed hot dog. Yes, indeed, in a city where hot dogs are something of a specialty, the humble sausage is being reinvented. From Chicago, Nova Sappho has that story.
The grill starts sizzling at Chicago's most popular hot dog restaurant at 10:30 in the morning. That's when the doors open and customers flood in.
What can we get for you?
I will have the foie gras dog, the celebrity sausage, and the escargot.
Yes, that's a hot dog made of ground snail.
30.50, please.
Carl, thank you so much.
And yes, that's $30 for three hot dogs. We're at a hole-in-the-wall restaurant called Hot Doug's, named after owner Doug's son. He has a level of devotion from customers that borders on the religious. Outside the restaurant, there's a line 2 blocks long.
So if someone is said to me, you know, when I started doing this 14 years ago, oh, and at some point you will have a book, you'll be sitting down and chit-chatting with Anthony Bourdain for his TV show, it's like, okay, and can I have some of that crack?
The philosophy that brought Sun that much success is pretty simple. He expanded on the traditional Chicago hot dog, a beef sausage with chopped onions, tomatoes, bright green relish, and a pickle spear. But Doug's son added fine dining principles and unusual ingredients.
To me, a really good quality Chicago hot dog should be as satisfying and tasty as anything you would get in a 3-star restaurant.
Sun is getting ready to retire from the business this fall. Now other hot dog shops hope to capture some of his magic and his customers.
There's no such thing as a hot dog franchise in Chicago, but they might as well be a franchises because they're all exactly alike. And that's the environment that Hot Doug moved into that really stood out.
Journalist Mike Gebert has been covering Chicago's food scene for a decade. He says there's now a whole new niche industry of gourmet hot dog purveyors.
Finally, I think that's what we've seen happening, is we're getting these places that are trying a little harder, that's got some more exotic things on the menu.
Exotic things like elk meat or quail egg toppings.
Order number 24.
I meet Gebert at one of these new restaurants. It's called Ivy's. Owner Tony Tsubras greets us with a heaping plate of food.
We have the Greek hot dog with the imported feta cheese, homemade tzatziki sauce, the famous Japanese dog. What we've done there is use seaweed salad, house-made wasabi mayonnaise, and we char-grill that hot dog.
Tsubras says his gourmet menu is a response to modern-day competitive pressures.
So years ago, you know, you could open up a new restaurant, just open the doors and expect people to walk in. But nowadays, it's a whole different market. You have social media that really directs a lot of your customer base. You have to be on top of your game. You have to serve the best. There's no other way.
But is a seaweed hot dog a good way to stand out?
Now I'm going to
put the microphone down now and start eating.
All right, here we go with a Japanese hot dog.
And a big mouthful later.
Wow.
Is that
pretty darn good. It's just missing ketchup.
Oh, no.
Kidding.
Don't
kidding.
Say that. Yeah. Please.
Well, partly kidding. I still can't resist wanting to put ketchup on a hot dog. In Chicago, I'm Nova Sappho for Marketplace.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
This final note on the way out today, an object lesson in why we still have to do stories about the financial crisis almost 6 years after the collapse of Lehman Brothers. I'm going to read a quote from an interview that Bloomberg did with Angelo Mozzillo, the former chairman of the board and CEO of Countrywide Financial, the biggest of the big subprime lenders. Here's the quote from the piece. Mozzillo doesn't understand why he and his firm, blamed by lawmakers and authorities for lax underwriting and predatory lending, have been seen as villains. This now is a quote from Mozzillo. No, 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 we didn't do anything wrong, he said. So there you go. That's Marketplace on this Tuesday. Today, the Dow off 30 points, about 0.2%. The NASDAQ up 17 points, almost 0.4%. The S&P 500 gave back a point. That is less than 0.1% if you're doing the math. Our special projects team is Nancy Fargali and Millie Jefferson. Lindsay Thomas and Caitlin Esch are on the Wealth and Poverty Desk. Our digital producers are Ariana Tobin, Shea Huffman, and Tony Wagner. I'm Kai Rizdal. We'll see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.